listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that just had a 5.2% price increase. I'm Scott Phillips, and I'm joined by the straw man, the man who started, manages, and runs strawman.com. He is, of course, Andrew Page. G'day, mate. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Don't forget Coffee Boy,
Chief Cook, Water Washer. Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yep. Nice.
Toilet cleaner. All of it. A man of many talents.
But yeah, Jack of all trades and master of none.
Yes, pretty much.
You said that, not me. mate, thank you for joining me as you do every single week, twice a week. We've got some lovely feedback from our listeners who are really enjoying and appreciating the work we're doing. So we appreciate that. Thank you for sharing that feedback. But mate, we just do it because it's fun. And so hopefully we're helping some listeners along the way learn a little bit, stay a little bit calm, particularly in times like these, and maybe make a little bit of sense of what's going on in the financial world. Speaking of which, we have a lot to talk about. This has been one of those weeks, mate, where I've done a bit of media this week, and when people kind of list off the five or six things that are going on right now, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, it is kind of one of those weeks, isn't it? And so that's kind of what we'll spend a bit of today's podcast talking about, because there are so many moving parts right now. And the general question for most of it was, how do I make sense of what the hell's going on and what I should expect next? So we'll spend a little bit of time on that. Of course, the 5.2% price increase I mentioned at the top is 5.2% increase on zero, which, if my maths doesn't fail me, is still zero. So the good news is Motley Fool Money remains free. You're welcome. Or not, as the case might be. Maybe we should be paying you to listen. But in any case, there was so much happened this week. We'll try and get through some of it. Let's start with the market. You and I recorded, we're pre-recording some mailbag episodes, as our listeners well and truly know by now, because I'm going away for a few weeks in a couple of weeks' time. And we recorded one on Tuesday of this week when the market completely fell out of bed. It was down about 3.6%. And you and I both...
Down 5% when we were recording.
At one point, correct, exactly. Down 5.4%, I think, was the worst it got to. Not very often you can make a 1.8% gain during a trading day and still be down 3.6%, but that's what happened on Tuesday. And yes, we look at our portfolios after the market, after the podcast finished, and went, oh, okay, it's one of those days. So it was interesting. It was an interesting
day. Off to
the
pub.
Exactly. It's a good drink. No. We're probably doing things remotely, mate. If we wanted to, we'd have to go separately by ourselves, which, you know, is not so cool at 10:30 in the morning.
As long as we're numbing the pain in some way, exactly. Shape or form.
Exactly. Now, mate, it came as a result, as we said on the podcast, which you'll hear in a couple of weeks, but it came after two consecutive days of big falls on Wall Street. I love a public holiday as much as anybody. I did have a day off on Monday because the ASX was closed, which was lovely. But that happened to be between the two big falls on Wall Street. So by the time we opened on Tuesday, we had 2 days to catch up on, which is part of what, frankly, why the fall was so bad on Tuesday. Friday night, the market fell 2.5% on Wall Street. Then it was at another 4%, I think, on Monday night our time. So by the time we caught up on all that, it was always going to be the case. And the concern really was the usual, right? We've talked about this so many times, but it's inflation interest rates problem of simply the market not knowing what's going on. I'm going to call it just indiscriminate selling. I'm going to call this pure fear and panic. Is that a reasonable... So when a market falls 6.5% in two trading days, either something has fundamentally changed meaningfully in the space of 12 and a half trading hours, or the market has kind of lost its collective head. Which of those do you reckon it is, mate?
I think it's kind of one leads to the other almost, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
true.
It's sort of like, you know, everyone's sort of... We're all on the battlefield. We're all holding the line until there's a rout. You know, and you think, no, I'm still here. No, everyone's running. Okay, I'm running too. You know, it really tests everyone. There is strength in numbers.
Yeah.
And even the most ardent sort of long-term unemotional investor will get rattled when you see that happen. You really start to question yourself. Like,
what am I missing?
I actually thought this would be good. I said I'd buy if this would happen nothing's changed with my companies, and you keep sort of repeating it to yourself, and then you look at the screen and you hit refresh and you hit refresh and you hit refresh. You're like, okay, it's hard. It's hard.
Mate, I'll cop to that during COVID. I mean, I actually did keep buying, but I got to say, like, during that period of time, there was more than once when I went, what if it really is different this time? But, you know, for all of my optimism and confidence, maybe what if, maybe this time finally, maybe, you know, this is the exception that proves the rule. It's a constant, that constant doubt, right? The not sure if the angel or the devil on the shoulder, maybe the devil in this case, just whispering, you know, you sure? Are you sure? Maybe, what if? Maybe, maybe, maybe. And yeah. It really does test you, no matter how strongly you believe. And I'm proud to say, and also I want to say, because it's important for our listeners, that I did, despite all that, keep buying during COVID. And I've said before, I bought Webjet in the early days of COVID because, hey, surely they're not going to ban international travel for a year and a half, are they? They did. So, you know, I made some mistakes of assumption there too. Whether or not I'm made whole in the fullness of time, we'll find out. But it's just an interesting experience to have gone through. And I think you're right, this time around it's the same. It is though, one of the things I try and say regularly, I've said a couple of times this week actually, is these people are supposed to be the masters of the universe, the highly paid glass wall office, million-dollar traders who know everything and do everything and all that kind of stuff. They're often the ones out there doing the selling, the indiscriminate selling of kind of like the panic throw the toys out of the cot selling. Is that a fair characterization?
That's an overly generous characterization. I would say.
Oh dear, here we go. Go on.
There are no. I've said it, there are no adults. There are no adults. Like there are some incredible in any industry you care to name. You know, I mean, whether you're talking about bricklaying or you know, doctors or financial traders, incredibly talented, intelligent, capable people.
Yep.
But there's also a lot of, you know, of the other side of the coin there too. And it's very true in that industry. I mean, the closer you get to some of this stuff, the more you realize that just people are making it up as they go. And then, there's a bit different, said it before, there's this thing called the share market.
Yeah.
But there's millions of people playing thousands of different types of games, you know?
Yeah.
And the games that those people, I say guys because generally it's just unfortunately male-dominated industry, which probably points to a lot of its lesser redeeming qualities. Very, very testosterone, ego-driven, all the bad parts of our psyche.
Yeah.
But they're not doing what I would imagine or hope at least that most sensible retail investors who are just trying to build long-term wealth are doing.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to be smarter than the next person and they're trying to take risks and they're trying to measure themselves against quarterly, semi-annual and annual benchmarks. They're trying to get their bonus. Mm. They're trying to second guess. Well, they're doing the Keynesian beauty contest more than sound long-term fundamental analysis.
Describe the Keynesian beauty contest for us, mate, for those who don't know the concept.
So Keynes, a famous economist, basically said that with markets, it's not so much. It's a horribly dated and sexist analogy. So you just like acknowledge that. But it's you know, with these horrible things called beauty contests, the job of the trader is not to be like the judge and hey, pick the prettiest girl. Mm-hmm. The job is to pick the one that you think everyone else will pick as the prettiest girl.
Yeah.
And then you get to a meta sort of level where it's like, well, actually, if everyone's playing that, my job is to guess what everyone else will guess, where everyone thinks is the prettiest girl. It's kind of another turtles all the way down kind of scenario. Yes. Yeah. But that's what people are doing on the market. Well, a lot of people, and as you say, expensive suit, glass walled, high-rise office kind of people are doing it. It's like they're not necessarily buying XYZ because they think it's a great company, but because they think everyone else will think it's a great company based on their assumption of the next lot of economic data that people are thinking. It's crazy kind of stuff. I think that's our trouble, is we do give a lot of these people far more credit than they deserve.
Yeah, and this, you know, I have explained that, or maybe I've exasperated that thought many times, but it's a nice little version of exactly that, right? The idea that you let the market tell you what to think. Because as you say, there's some irony, the way you describe it is like, there's out there people that are trading trying to do this, and then there's people out there doing sensible things, like trying to invest for the long term, and that's retail investors. And it's almost completely, I won't say whatever about, it's almost, you know, it's backwards, right? Because the idea should have been, there's always professionals, long-term investing, doing the right thing for value, while all the retail investors are out there doing stupid things. And it's very, I mean, yeah, there's some retail investors doing stupid things, and there are some institutional investors doing some really smart things. But to your point, in a given day, it's not, we take our cues from the market full of people doing silly short-term things. When we're trying to invest for the long term, you and I would say, and the market may even disagree with us, certainly some of those traders would absolutely disagree with us, but we would say the smart money, air quotes smart money should be, is investing for the long term, ignoring the volatility. Except every day you look at the market, the so-called smart money are generally the guys, as you say, but also some girls, who are whipsawing the market backwards and forwards, trying to do this beauty contest, trying to guess what might happen next, full of fear, full of panic, full of greed, full of enthusiasm and exasperation and everything in between. It literally is a pretty backwards kind of scenario, right?
There's a great book we've probably mentioned before on the pod is Where Are All the Customers' Yachts?
Yeah, we have. It's great.
And it's great. There's all kinds of saying. It's like it's the only job where people, what is it, people on Wall Street drive to Wall Street in their Rolls Royce to take advice from people who catch the train. I remember my first or second year working for a major brokerage. I sort of fought my way up the ranks. It's just, rising tide lifted all boats kind of phenomenon. It was the tech boom. Can you fog a mirror? Right, we'll take you. You've got a job. Anyway, I eventually found myself on a research desk and was so excited. And we were putting together a research report. I think it was Brambles or something at the time. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
And obviously there are trading rules. Like you're locked out of trading your own personal account until your research is released. I remember we were putting the final touches on this report. And I said to the boss, it's just like, how many are you going to buy when we're allowed to? Because it was a buy recommendation. Right. It's a strong buy recommendation, in fact. And he's like, I'm not buying it. And it was it is etched in my brain.
That piece of rubbish. Yeah, right.
Like from 20 years ago, I remember that so vividly. It's like, but we just spent the last few months working on, this is a really good buy.
Yeah.
We're allowed to buy this, a week from now. Why? He's like, no, I'm just... got a mortgage to pay. I'm buying investment property. Not to say that I expected him to back up the truck and put his life savings in it, but I thought you might put a little bit of money on it, right? Like we are literally telling our clients that we really like this stock. And then the longer you, it's just very hard not to be jaded and cynical after. I couldn't wait to get out because that was actually really common. It was a really common thing. It's like, look, my job is to put together something, right? I'm putting it together. Seems good. Not that I'm being that disingenuous. I don't think it's horrible, but someone says, what do I buy? I put some reason, here it is. Okay, great. But it's not for me. It really stuck in my craw. And I think it's just emblematic of so much that's wrong with the industry. So again, I've got to be careful what I say here because I'll get in trouble. And that's not, there'll be, as I know, a lot of people in the industry are just really smart, really ethical, really honest people doing their best.
Both of them. People. Correct.
Both
those people are wonderful. Exactly.
They are great people. but it's a good reminder not to see the person on telly or on the new whatever saying, just to treat them as some high priest of who knows everything, and they don't. It was at the ASA conference I mentioned a little while ago. Marcus Padley was there, so a well-known stockbroker. He just gave this speech where he said the 10 biggest secrets that the industry doesn't want you to know, and he was kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Right, okay.
I was stuck to my chair. I was just like, oh my God, he is going to get lynched. Like, what are you saying? He was just a master. Like, he had the floor. They were just like on the floor laughing. But it was kind of like, it was funny because the best comedy is couched in truth, right?
Yeah, that's right. Right.
And it's just
if you don't laugh, you cry. Is that kind of stuff?
It was just such a surreal. I guess we all laugh because we all think, "Ha, that's how it is." But I'm smart, and it's not. I don't fall for that.
I think
we all like to sort of think that. But anyway. It's a potent reminder not to take too much of this stuff too seriously. Can I read you a quote I found because it was you reminded me when you your very first question before it kicked off all of this. It's from a guy called John Mills back in 1867. And you were talking about sort of panics and what's happened on markets. And he said, panics do not destroy capital. They merely reveal the extent to which it has previously been destroyed by its betrayal into hopelessly unproductive works. And I just I saw that on Twitter. I thought, I love that. Because I think what happens is that usually the die is cast, at a certain point. And we sort of go on in our collective delusion until it's just sort of the weight of reality cannot be held back anymore. It's like all of the excess, the malinvestment, the just it becomes too big to ignore. Yep, yep. And that is when the panic sets in, when it's kind of like, okay, we were happy to dance, but now the music has stopped. There's 100 of us in these four chairs.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
It's kind of crazy. Now, so all of that being said, which is, I guess, people listening to this ill-thought-through rant will be like, so you're saying it's all rigged, and it's like, well, I kind of am to some extent, but I'm also saying that this is actually a wonderful thing for those who can play the smarter game and look through all of this stuff, because while people are playing silly buggers with all of these financial instruments, underneath it all there's a real business there. You know, there'll be some really terrible businesses that won't last the next year or two, but there'll be some really wonderful ones that'll live for the next century. And when this happens, like, everything gets thrown out. Lots of babies get thrown out with the bathwater, and it sucks. Okay. It sucks to see your portfolio down. But these are the times where future fortunes are made. And as I've said repeatedly, your job as an investor more than anything is just to survive, survive and add. And just the first rule of compounding: never interrupt it. You know,
and it is
precisely because of these kinds of events that we get such wonderful long term returns.
Yeah.
Because most people can't stand it, but if you can, and you can not play the silly bugger games, and you can not take these idiots too seriously, and you can remember exactly. I love this quote from Peter Lynch, which is: "Know what you own and why you own it."
Yeah,
I think good. I'm going to get. I don't have any tats, but if I did, I'd probably get that across. Written in reverse or across my forehead, so every time I look in the mirror, I could remind myself. But it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful idea, and I think it's a good touchstone in these very difficult times.
That's great, man. I like it. I like it a lot. It's important. I think you're right. I will say, if I can add to that quote a little bit, the market also goes too far, right?
Yeah.
So the only other thing I want to add to that is. You know what? We've talked about the word correction before, which I despise. We've also mentioned what my suggestion was, which is to call it an up-rection, which you thought was hysterically funny. This is many years ago.
And we had one. It just sounds a little bit rude. That's why I think my 14-year-old self finds that hilarious.
And we had one person on Twitter remind me of it this week, so I thought I'd throw it back into the podcast. But there is, you know, there are a whole lot of, investing is weird, right? You've got to at some point have two things in your mind at the same time. The optimism to believe that things are going to get better and therefore value is going to be created and share price is going to go up. At the same time, the reality of, you know, not getting carried away with the bubbles and the exuberances and the everything else. And trying to keep those two things in your mind at the same time. Be optimistic without getting carried away. So what ends up happening, a lot of market commentators tend to be these dour types who every correction is real and every gain is false. And if you think about the idea of a correction when the market drops 10%, the market has gone up 10% per year on average for a century, right? And yet we say when the market drops 10%, oh, that's a correction. As if that's the natural state of things, that naturally they should go down and therefore going down makes it okay or makes it right. And so I wanted to throw that corollary to your point, which is a very, very well-made one, which is just that the flip side is Templeton's quote about buying when there's blood in the streets.
Yeah.
Because panics don't just, you know, show the over-exuberance. They do in the early stages, then they keep going. And then they go to the point of, yeah, you know, kind of trading away real value because everyone's still too scared. And I don't know where we are. I'm not saying we're at that point now, by the way. Maybe we may not. But I just want to kind of flag that because it's worth, I think, calling out a little bit. Just that very idea of thinking about, you know, yes, panics are good to show where value's been destroyed, but then they also go too far and actually do destroy real value, at least in the short term, if it sold in April 2020. At the bottom of the COVID crash or at the bottom of the GFC in 2009 or whatever, you weren't at that point, you know, sensibly, you know, highlighting the fact that, okay, I was obviously 40% wrong previously because the market's then recovered that and more since. Even after the crash this week, it's still above where it was the peak of 2020 before the crash. So I just want to throw both those thoughts in just for the fun of it.
I'll give you another quote.
Please.
I love a good quote.
You do.
If it's not abundantly obvious.
it is.
William Bernstein is actually a psychiatrist, I think, and financial theoretician, that's the word, said, what separates the professional from the amateur are two things. He's talking about the professional investor.
Yeah.
First, the knowledge that brutal bear markets are a fact of life and that there is no way to avoid their effects. And second, that when times get tough, the former stays the course, the latter abandons the blueprints or more often than not has no blueprints at all.
Yeah.
And I think that really nails it as well. Just reiterate the core idea here. It is a fact of life. You can't avoid them, right? Whether you're no matter how smart or seasoned or experienced that you are.
Yeah.
But the difference is that those who know what they're doing just stay the course and sticks to the plan. And the plan is, as Buffett says, it's simple but not easy. It's just good quality companies at sensible prices. Like that's it, right?
Yeah,
that's
totally.
The plan. That doesn't mean that things, you know, line goes up. That doesn't mean that it's not scary, but that you do that and you do that over a very long period of time.
Yeah.
You're just going to make a lot of money. You're going to build a lot of wealth and you're going to create a lot of freedom for yourself and your family. Like generational wealth if you do it long enough.
Is it not fair though? That quote, was that saying the professionals are good at this stuff and the amateurs walk away when it gets tough?
No. What he's saying is that there's going to be a bear market and we're all going to get hit by it.
Okay.
But he's saying that the amateur freaks out and runs away. So this is why you have so many people, if you ever speak to at a barbecue or whatever, it's like, oh, the share market's a casino. It's a mugs game. I bought, you know, because what most people do, and we're all guilty of this to some extent when we first start, is you hear about this thing called the market. You find out that all your friends and neighbors are making easy money.
That's right.
And all you hear in the office or at the work site is, oh, I bought blah, 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 and it went up. Yeah, okay, that sounds a bit risky. I'm not interested. And after a year or two of hearing that, you're like, screw this. I'm getting involved, right? Yeah. So you buy pretty much near the top. There's a route. It falls out and you go, oh, screw this. So I didn't have a blueprint. I didn't have a plan. I got the hell out. Mm-hmm. So my experience of the share market is you buy and then all your money disappears. Mm-hmm. Where the more rational person just goes, well, A, it's a part of it, but my plan was never to try and time this thing. My plan was, as I say, good business is a good product. That's the blueprint. That's the plan. So that's the distinguishing feature is that you stick to the course.
Yeah. The only thing I want to challenge, though, is the professionals bit running away, not the amateur running away, the professionals staying the course. Because as we just talked about this week, I dare say professionals are doing 90% of the selling.
Yeah, professional's the wrong word.
I think not to disagree with you. I think you're absolutely right in terms of that's where the value is, and that's the successful investor is one who hangs around, right? Yeah. Successful over time. If you're not successful yet, you will be by hanging around rather than running away. I just want to highlight that because in the context of what we just talked about, that might give a little bit too much credit to the professionals.
Yeah, the professional is the wrong word he's used there.
I know what you mean.
Definitely.
It's absolutely the right point. Mate,
one more thing. Sorry. One more thing.
Go for it.
It's a little bit of bugbear for me is that the day that we were recording that pre-record and the market was down 5%, I think we sort of set off, might have been off air. It's just like, I wonder how many billions are going to be wiped off the market. And so whenever there's a big fall, and sure as night follows day, that afternoon, of course, my news feed and the papers are all like, I think it was 87 billion wiped off the market. Cue the picture of the New York trader with his head in his hands and et cetera, et cetera. But if the market goes up and it looks like it'll be up today, no one says 34 billion wiped on to the market today.
Yeah, exactly.
Why don't we say that?
But that's what I mean about the pessimism thing, mate. There's the kind of the air quote sensible people and the journalists. I love journalists. It's such an important role. And I'm never, ever critical, well, sometimes critical, of proper journalists, right? Because they do their best and they don't always do it great. But, you know, they're an important function. The Fourth Estate is really, really, really important for our democracy. So I'm a massive fan of quality journalism.
Me too.
But there is some sense of it's always the pessimistic, always that. And I get it, right? They're trying to punch holes in things. They're trying to, you know, speak truth to power. They're trying to find the lies. And I, it's kind of an occupational hazard, right? But again, in a market that goes up 10% a year on average over time, has created stupendous amounts of wealth. That idea that, ha, I got you, the market's down a bit, so he told you, wiped off. That general inclination. And I get it. I'm going to be critical of that inclination in the way it's applied in this case. Not they shouldn't report fully and totally and, you know, comprehensively and, you know, skewer the Enrons of the world. And that's a really important job to be done there. But just that idea of, as you say, the if it bleeds, it leads staff combined with the pessimism, all business are out there to screw people. All they're going to do is work out how they're doing it, why they're doing it and expose them. You know, even when that's true to some degree, I wonder about the balance, given the evidence, given the stupendous evidence of more than a century of history. When you spend your life trying to find the downside, it's like, I think you're missing you're literally missing the story. That's not the story, right? The story is the 16-fold gain in wealth between 91 and 2021. How many journos wrote that story versus the journos that wrote about the 10% corrections and the wiped off stories and the whatever else is? And I do wonder if there's some element of missing the point there.
Yeah, it was. You definitely know it's a bad day when the finance leads the news, as it did on Tuesday. It's normally just before the weather at the end of the bulletin, but when it leads, it's like it never leads for good reasons. if it bleeds, it leads.
Correct. I do a couple of podcasts other than this one, and I do some Nine News stuff at night, and yes, every now and again I get told, "Oh, we're going to put you off for the first break." It's like, "Oh, okay, cool."
Not a good day.
I appreciate, but I'm the guy they call when there's bad news. Like, "Oh, really? We're going to have Scott on again?" "Oh, really? What happened?" But yes, it's one of those. Yeah. One of those things. It's a bit of fun. Mate, let's move on, though, to the news. And speaking of journos and speaking of all that kind of stuff, Governor Lowe, Philip Lowe, the Reserve Bank head honcho, the head mandarin, the man at the top of the very, very pointy triangle of Reserve Bankness, made that up, spoke to Lee Sales on ABC 7:30 this week. And it's had come into some criticism. I'd be curious for your thoughts. But I thought it was a welcome... A couple of points to make. A welcome change. He hasn't. I don't think he's given a view like that in a very, very long time. But to my knowledge, lots of speeches at conferences and lots of Senate testimonies and that kind of stuff. Not a lot of sitting down with a journal and actually talking about what's going on. So I liked that. I thought that was positive.
Yep.
I will say, by the way, I can't help but avoid the suspicion there is politics at play somewhere here. And I'm not even sure who to blame or where to point some fingers, but both... Governor Lowe and the Treasury Secretary, I think I want to say Stephen Kennedy, but I might be making that up, have both spoken very candidly in the last week and a half, having not really spoken that candidly at any point previously. And I don't know whether they're muzzled by the previous mob, where the current mob said, get out there and tell everyone the bad news because we've just taken over and man, things are crook and we want to go and set that story. Or they've just said, do whatever you want. Or maybe independently, those two guys have just said, I think that's probably a good time to go and chat. I don't know which of those things is true. It doesn't even really matter that much. But it's just, it seems a little too convenient, doesn't it?
They're all out there now. I'd be really concerned if whether or not the Reserve Bank governor is being directed by whatever political party happens to be in power. I think that'd be a really bad scenario. Maybe as you say, who knows, maybe it is. But if that came out, it'd be like, aren't you meant to be independent? Like
that's right.
You've got nothing to do with the electoral. You're there to sort of set a sensible monetary policy. That's what you're there for, the greater good of the country, regardless of who's in power. I'd be really upset.
Yeah.
I think I'd be marching in the street probably by myself and three other people if that was the case. I mean, it's a big deal. Like, it affects everyone. Like,
but I will say, for whatever the cause, and the cause should be probably investigated and resolved, I'm very, very glad that both of them are speaking and speaking relatively candidly. At least I don't know what they're not saying. We can't know by definition what punches they're pulling or not pulling. But both have been really, really candid. The Treasury Secretary is saying we've got a tax problem. We have got a structural budget problem that we have not addressed, and I've been saying this for years and years. Literally, almost as long as I've been at the Montefiore. We have a structural budget deficit that no bastard wants to fix, and that is not okay. Governor Lowe didn't really come out with too much in the way of pronouncements in terms of that sort of policy or circumstantial criticism, but he was very, I thought, clear and forthright about what's going on in the economy. The big one was he said he thinks inflation is going to be 7% by the end of the year. I am going to say, Matt, I think that's an underestimate. If I'm going to take an under or an over on that one, I'm taking the overs on 7% by December, but I could be wrong. So that was, I thought that was noteworthy. He also discussed the 2024 problem, promise/guarantee/indication, whatever it was. Of course, you remember that people were reporting regularly that Governor Lowe said that rates wouldn't go up till 2024. And of course, they're going up in 2022 and up a long way and very quickly. I am on record. We don't take many victory laps by ourselves. We occasionally take victory laps. Let our members do it on our behalf, which is always lovely. But we have been saying, or I've been saying, I think you've been saying, right through the last couple of years, Lowe never, ever, 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 ever said rates wouldn't go up till 2024. What he said was they would go up when wages and prices went up, and he thought that would be in 2024. And that's a really important distinction, right? Because he never actually, the media reported, much of the media said, Governor Lowe said 2024 is as early as it'll be. Now, I thought at the time it was likely to be too late. I thought they'd go up before then. It was my view because inflation was already moving. I think he was wrong. But he never said that. I think the media have a bit to be responsible for that, putting that expectation in people's heads based on something he didn't actually say. I will say, and he acknowledged that, that I will say that he also could have very clearly and earlier said, no, I didn't say that. Here's actually what I said. This is important. You need to take note of that. He didn't say that either. So he bears some responsibility, but I thought that was interesting as well. What did you take from his chat with Lee Sales, mate?
Yeah, I'm just scrolling here looking, trying to find the quote, and here it is. Sometimes my comments get interpreted as me having made a promise or a very strong statement. Interest rates would stay where they were until 2024. In our communication, our own way of thinking was very much a conditional statement.
Yeah.
Now, yeah.
but that's exactly what he did. That's important, right? Because he's actually right. And I've been saying that for a couple of years now. Whenever we've talked about this, I've always made the point, I think I was, if I try to make it always, that he never said that. He always said, if and when, these are, we think it'll be here because we're waiting for these things to happen. We think these things will happen in 2024, and so that's when we think rates will go up. It was always conditional to his point.
Yeah, so he did. He said that, and then the media heard something else, and they reported it very differently, right?
Yes.
Now, that didn't happen in a vacuum, and that didn't happen in one, you know, in a very quick period of time and then something. He said something and then he knew how it was interpreted and how it was received. I personally at that point would have thought, I feel as though I need to clarify my statements here. So what I actually said was this.
Yep.
I feel as though everyone's reporting that I'm making a I'm not. So I just want to emphasize that. And he had multiple, not just the chance to pick up the phone and speak to the media, but just in the official RBA minutes. He could have said,
it's important to note that. Yes.
Let me clarify.
Yeah.
And so I feel as though that's in a, like, so while he can't be blamed for how it was received and reported on, he let that run. He let that story run. Yep. And I felt that was a mistake.
Yep.
I also feel it always makes me laugh / cry when people like this will say, and it's like, found a million examples of it, right? So, Janet Yellen recently, I realized that our expectations were wrong, but here's what I think now. I was like, whoa, at what point do we stop going on? And again, it's not to be critical because these things are diabolically hard to forecast. Yeah. Probably impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just like, if you had asked my forecast for something the last 100 times in a row and I'd been wrong 90 times, after a point, stop asking, right?
Like
it's not that, I value what he's, what do you think? I'm really interested to know. But the problem is it continually gets reported as fact and people take it as fact. And we need to remember it's just a flesh and blood human with all the frailties and all the weaknesses and all the flaws that all of us have. He's not some high priest of the economy that sees through time that none of us can, mere mortals can possibly understand. Goodness sakes, people, let's one guy's opinion, great. Yeah. Probably opinion that's more valuable than a lot of others, but it's an opinion and it's almost, if history is any guide, certain to be wrong. So let's just keep things in context.
I'm going to step off that quickly, mate. We're not going to spend too long on this because this is kind of central bank arcana at some level. But I also wish they would say less. And I know that's exactly the opposite of most people, most journos, most market watchers, most market participants, most of everybody. Because, and to your exact point there, mate, this is really, really, really important. And it's really hard to get across to people because it talks about their psychological biases. And if you have those biases, it's very hard to see them. And if you can't see them, then you won't agree with what I'm about to say, right? Which is a big setup to say the central banks say things because people want to hear them for exactly the reason you asked, that, well, at least a forecast is better than nothing, right? ... And the big answer with an exclamation mark is, hell no. That in itself is the problem. Had they not felt obliged to make a forecast, had they not said anything about 2024, we may or not be in a very different position today. And given they're probably going to be wrong more often than right, or even wrong as often as right, half the time, it's by definition entirely useless. And yet the markets want something, so they say, well, at least it's a forecast, better than nothing, right? That assumption, that psychological trap is so pervasive. There are super smart, super capable, very highly paid people who said the same thing to me before. I've said, companies shouldn't give earnings forecasts for exactly the same reason. And people said to me, professional, people who work in the industry, well, what else do we use? So I don't know, mate, but don't, like, you know, just because you ask for it.
That's your job, man.
Right, well, we're also making forecasts ourselves. That whole process is the problem. That whole idea that I have to know because I have to use that to do something with it, blah, 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 blah. That whole, entire way of thinking, that whole stream of work that's created from the central banks and from companies to the pundits and the economists and the journos and the analysts and the shareholders, the whole thing, we continue this bloody silly, you know, palaver in. Buffett's never done DCF in his life. Now, he can probably do it in his head, so let's keep that in mind. But just that idea that, you know, the market is more informed, in air quotes, that at least we know what to expect. Your point is absolutely 100% valid, which is it's useless. Stop doing it and stop relying on it. It's one of those study done years ago, apparently, that there's someone, they took away all the stop signs in the streets of some town in the US, right? And traffic accidents went down because people went, I better be careful then. I shouldn't rely on the stop sign. I'll actually make sure no one's going to run into me. That'd be a good idea. And so it's that idea of, like, just because we have the information, our level of confidence goes up, when it really shouldn't, because there's no statistical basis for it. And yet we all do it. And it's, I would happily say to the RBA, everyone wants Lowe to go to a press conference. Oh, about time there's a press conference. Now we can hear what he's thinking and saying. And it's like, no, do the reverse. Yeah. Governor, go and lock yourself in your office. Don't talk to anybody ever. Just do your thing. You know, well, you'd be wrong, you'd be right. Go on.
Was it? Yeah, it's a point well made, and I don't disagree with you on the specifics. And I think well, the difference is, I feel as though this was really apparent during the 7:30 interview, is that there just feels to be, not from even from seasoned journalists like Lee Sales, there just seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding as to exactly what this guy is capable of, what right. his role is.
Right.
Right. Like, he's, as we've talked about repeatedly, it's a very, my job is to keep inflation within the target band.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's a little bit more complex, but basically that's it, right?
They have a full employment mandate as well.
Yes, they do. But that's basically it, right?
Yeah.
And there's only so much I can do. I've got one giant lever to do it, but it's kind of spoken as if, like, you've got all of these kinds of things. So while I don't want Lowe to get out there and say, this is what we expect and this is what the inflation rate, that is 100% wrong, and they shut the hell up, right?
Yeah.
But I do think it is valuable for the sake of clarity to say, listen, everyone, this is my job. Yep. These are the data points that we are watching.
Yep.
These are the things that we will cause us to move, if and when they might not. But here's our strategy. Yeah. Here's our plan. Yeah. So when I speak to management all the time as part of Strawman. Yeah. I never once say what its earnings per share going to be.
Yeah.
But I spend a lot of time saying, what's the strategy?
Yes.
What are the risks?
I completely agree with you.
You know, absolutely. I want to know the game plan, right? Now, you can't know what's going to happen, and please don't give me a forecast. It's a waste of time. But I really, 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 really want to know how you're planning to steer the ship here. Because so I think we're probably agreeing here, it's more the subtle point. So if he and others in their position locked themselves and never said anything, that's worse to my mind.
Yep.
It's just as bad as them coming out saying inflation will be 7% by the end of the year, and this is what, you know, like, that's bad too. In between all of that is, let me remind you, this is our job. These are the things that we're watching. These are the things we're concerned about. If things go this way, this is what's probably going to be our move. So we all like, know it. What the game plan is.
Yep.
That's what they need to do.
Yep. No, I think it's a really smart, and I would completely agree with you. I think, say, you know, company wise, you know, I don't care what Apple's earnings are next quarter. What I care about is their strategy around services and devices and upgrade cycles and whatever. Here is how we're going to try and run our business. Here's what we're aiming to do. Here's what we're looking towards. Here's how we think we're going to create value. We'll do our best. It's like, cool, got it. No worries. That makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah, and imagine if Tim Cook just never spoke. You know, what are they thinking? What's the plan?
I mean, I would actually rather, if I had to choose between that and not giving forecasts, I'd choose that. I mean, Buffett basically does the Berkshire meeting and some TV interviews. Doesn't do analyst one-on-ones. Doesn't meet with other companies. Right? He just, like, I've told you what I've told you. It's there. Do your thing. So somewhere in between there is real. Honestly, mate, if he never spoke at all, I would have no issues with it at all across the
even
entire,
not at the AGM. I mean, the whole point of the AGM is to talk to the owners of the business.
Yeah,
we employ Apple shareholders employ Tim Cook.
Yep.
We elect a board to sort of to keep an eye on things.
Yep.
He's our employee.
Yep.
And I don't look. You know, I don't want to pick up the phone every 5 minutes, but I do at least once a year say, how's my business going? What are your plans? What are you thinking? I think it's entirely appropriate for them to
I would be happy for that in the annual report, personally.
Okay.
But not. I mean, I'm not against the AGM. But like, you know, I'd be happy if they just left it at that. Right, go to the AGM, ask the questions, be accountable, be available, and then get on with running the business. The palaver of setting targets, trying to get them, managing Wall Street, talking to fund managers, all that kind of crap.
No, I'm with you there. Yeah.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
What other problems can we solve globally?
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem, mate. It's because I'm gonna ask you about the R word. Because the Wall Street rout on Friday and Monday, the ASX rout, I like the word rout, on Tuesday, is about interest rates and inflation in terms of the causal factors. But when you think about those causes and think about the effects, one effect was the share prices dropped, I would say precipitously, but, you know, by a bit in a single day. At one point, the worst day since March 2020. But the other cause, or the other effect of these causal factors may well be an American and possibly a worldwide recession, possibly as early as late this year or early next.
Mm.
And that's you know, we talk about the impact of inflation and interest rates, and we say, what do we do differently and all that kind of stuff. When interest rates are in and of themselves just changing the cost of money, that's one question. When the very real possibility, and by the way, we're going to talk about this, you know, we know that the US Fed on Wednesday night, Australian time, increased rates there by 0.75%.
Causing markets to rally.
Yeah, that was the other thing, right? So you work that out. We'll get to that in a sec. But rates are up and fast and hard and all that kind of stuff. This is not just a question of what number do we put in our discounted cash flows as the discount rate, but potentially, literally, what does it do to the sales and profits of some of our businesses? Because I think the betting is pretty much that America's odds on now for a recession at some point. And I think I would speculate as a result, Australia is very, very unlikely to avoid one if the Yanks have one. Your thoughts on kind of what probability of, likelihood of, impact of a recession globally and or here?
Well, the point of making forecasts is to make yourself look stupid in about 6 to 12 months' time. So I can go with that. I'm no stranger to making myself look like an idiot. I think it's going to happen. And again, I say, please don't at me on Twitter or whatever. Like, this is my armchair opining, you know. But I feel as though it's likely. And then what's the saying? Like, when the US sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold.
Yep.
And I feel as though it's what, a quarter of the global economy. You know, it's gonna have an impact. It's also the owner of the reserve currency. It's hard not to think that there's going to be flow-on impacts there.
Yeah.
There's also this really interesting dynamic between the world's first and second largest economy. Trimerica, as Niall Ferguson has termed it. So it's kind of like, you know, what impacts America will absolutely impact China, will probably impact Australia. It's just like, it's all connected. We all live on one planet with a global monetary sort of system. So
hold hands and sing kumbaya.
I think you know, if we were playing a game of SimCity,
yes.
I would say, bring it on. Right. Let's have a good. I would do the Paul Keating. There's a recession we need to have here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's do it. Bunch of malinvestment, a bunch of bad allocation, huge amounts of excess. I mean, for goodness sakes, people are buying digital monkeys at hundreds of thousands. Like, you know, the world has gone mad here.
Correct.
Like, we need things. There's been such a poor allocation of capital, and at the same time, there's just this huge growing inequality. Like, we need a reset. And so that's my academic, let's play the computer simulation and reset things. It's what economists call it sort of creative destruction. And when you look at it from a meta level, it's actually a wonderful thing, because it does help reset the system when we go on to the next stage of prosperity. Right. The reason I don't say that in reality is because the brutal truth of it is that, I mean, there is no economy. Like, let's just remind ourselves of that. There is just a bunch of people interacting, right? And that's what we call the economy. But when we say, oh, recession and it'd be good, a bit of creative destruction, rah, 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 what that means is a lot of people losing their jobs.
Yeah.
It means an increase in domestic violence, in suicides.
Yeah,
it means children going hungry. Like, I'm not over-egging it, right?
Yeah, no, totally. This is exactly
what it means. And you know what? For the top 30%, it's, oh, shit, my investment pardon my French, my investment property is down a little bit.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like, oh, no trip to the ski fields this year, kids. All right. Yeah. That's what it means. And it's, I'm not saying it's pleasant.
1 week rather than two. Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's what it means for people at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's really serious stuff. It's really, so I actually don't, that's where I find myself. On one hand, thinking that it's probably what we need. Mm. On the other hand, really, really terrified of the consequences. Yep. And here's the other problem. I say, okay, well, okay, let's put people first. Like that's always a good rule of thumb, right? Put people first.
Yeah, it's a good start.
And that's what governments have done in response to the GFC. That's what people did in response to COVID, right?
100%.
Consequences be damned. Let's print a bunch of cash and save people. And I'm not even being critical. It's like, what else do you do?
Yeah.
But if there's what's the word for it? It's a devil's choice or whatever the term is in the sense that okay, well let's do it all again.
Yeah.
Well, at a point, like I'm not. Let's take the extreme point. At a point, it leads to hyperinflation.
Yep.
And
that's the real, for me, that's the real risk is, you know, there is no good outcome here.
Yeah.
You've got to choose between lesser ongoing sustained, even if it's not hyperinflation, even just like high inflation for extended periods of time. It doesn't even have to be hyperinflation to be completely, if you get 7% for 4 years straight, that's 28% simple. It's probably 34%, bigger number, compounded. That means our purchasing power goes down by a third. We have to cut a third of our consumption without a pay rise.
Or put another way, your pay just got cut by a third.
By a third, right. And you've got to still try and live. And you know, it's massive.
Huge.
And so I think, you know, it's one thing for people to say, well, you know, we don't rates, inflation, blah, blah, blah. And 7% inflation feels like a lot. Also, doesn't feel like heaps. If you don't, you know, if you think, oh, it'll be over soon. If you let it get out of control, this is why central banks are so desperately scared. If you let it get out of control, you will kill the economy, you know, with kindness. Prices go up and up and up and up eventually. Consumption falls, standard of living falls precipitously, GDP will eventually decrease because everyone says, stuff this for a game of soldiers. You know, it has really insidious impacts. They just don't feel as significant up front because rate rises are an absolute dollar amount that I've got to pay more of. It's like, no, thank you, and I get it. But there's no easy out.
Look at, this has got to be the most underreported story of our times right now, is look at Sri Lanka.
Yeah. Yes, actually, that's a good point too.
Like, a lot of people might be thinking, well, what's going on there?
Yep.
Like, Google it, man. Like, this is what happens as a consequence of a very bad political management, economic decisions. Eventually, it catches up. And the trouble with it is that what it actually leads to is social unrest. It leads to populism. Mm-hmm. Yep. All of the worst things in history are usually economically precipitated at some point in time. I saw an interesting tweet on Twitter. I don't know. It made me think, put it that way, is that I think the elite, I think it's a kind of loaded term, but let's go with it. The elite actually prefer a recession because the alternative is them being drawn and quartered, you know, dragged out of their mansions and put into the gallows. Happened.
That is what ferments
all of these civil unrest because at a point when you, like, no one can be bothered going out in the street and protesting until you haven't eaten for a couple of days and things are getting real. And I, you know, it feels like, whoa, Andrew, settle down. You're being a bit crazy. And I am. I'm going to the extreme. Yeah. But this has actually happened on planet Earth. We are so shielded from it in the West. And this is the devil's bargain, I suppose, is the term I was looking for before, where you kind of have to go with the recession, even knowing the pain it causes. What frustrates me, mate, and I think I've probably said this already, but I'll say it again, is that we have this really diabolical problem and we just look to this guy over there with the hammer and say, can you sort it out for us, right? It's like, I feel as though there is too much emphasis put on central banks and there's too little emphasis put on fiscal policy and government policy. And like, there is one person with a lever, and there's another person sitting in front of this massive control panel, like NASA, right, with 400 levers and dials. Like, let's talk about what we can do over here, right?
Yeah, I've used that before, talking about the biplane, the RBA's flying versus the fighter jet the government's got with all the dials and switches, the heads-up displays, and everything else. I 100% agree with you. That being said, I'm gonna say what Paul Keating did say, and no other politician will ever say, that if we have a recession, it will be the recession we had to have, not because we wanted a recession per se. And this is where Keating told the truth, right? And he got pilloried because it was unpalatable.
It's like Hewson telling the truth.
Totally, right? So, yeah. And so I can, because I'm not, thank Christ, going for politics. Not because we want the recession itself. This is the mistake Keating made, was probably, it was a bit of a flippant throwaway. He didn't explain himself. We have to have higher interest rates to kill inflation because it is the least worst option that is available to us.
Mm.
And to the extent that's true, and maybe people can argue about that, but I'll argue that it is the best option available to us that we know of. So you say, okay, we have to have higher rates to kill inflation because inflation will kill us if we don't. So in that fight, if we end up with a recession, it will be the unavoidable recession that comes as a result of doing the right thing, which is what Keating really should have said, or words to that effect, yeah. Much less pithy, and Keating was known for his pithiness. So, you know, he wasn't wrong in terms of we had to have it because it had to be the end result of what, again, back then was actually trying to curb excesses that caused inflation. This almost like excesses of demand. It is largely supply driven, but it doesn't matter why it's here. If you let it become endemic, doesn't matter how you get crook. If you don't treat it, if you don't kill the virus, doesn't matter how you get it. Just kill the bloody virus, right? Because trying to live with it is, maybe it's possible. Maybe you're less sick. Maybe the drugs have side effects. I won't talk to the metaphor any further. But you know, the simple reality is, you know, they are the side effects you have to have if you believe the treatment is necessary to kill the virus. And I think we will have a recession. I would speculate, if I was going to just guess for the fun of it, as you said before, I think our first negative quarter is probably the December quarter, October, November, December. If I was going to guess, I don't know. Maybe it never happens. Maybe it comes earlier. Certainly, consumer sentiment out this week was terrible. It's almost the worst consumer sentiment numbers on record, as you would expect with inflation through the roof, the RBA jacking up rates, and people talking about a recession, funnily enough. And by the way, that actually might be a good thing. The best case outcome here would actually be that the RBA scares people into doing what it wants them to do without having to put rates up. That would actually be a great outcome, because it would mean you get the economic outcomes without higher rates than would otherwise be the case. That's actually a great solution if we can get there. So maybe they end up having that impact anyway, but it is going to be a tough year or so. Investing-wise, mate, if you think about a recession, you mentioned before about, you know, forecasts make us look silly. But let's get it back to investing. We spent a lot of time on macro.
It is ostensibly an investing podcast.
Yeah, firstly, there wasn't much company news out this week, really, honestly. We did have a check and look around. But between minimum wage, consumer confidence, rates up, inflation up, US rates up, Governor Lowe's speech, and you know, this is shares crashing. This is a week for the macro, right? So on one hand, sorry if you were here for the individual and company analysis, you're not going to get any today. I probably should have said at the beginning, but maybe you turned off, so you've stuck with it this long. Thank you. It wasn't deliberate, by the way.
I can hear the sound of the podcast machines going click, 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 click.
Exactly. Luckily, the podcast machine doesn't have a stop button the way I invent them anyway, mate. Special Motley Fool Money podcast machine that has to, once you start it, you're locked in. Plus, we might say something interesting later. They don't want to miss that. But yes, it's a macro pod because it's been a macro pod. I don't remember what the point I was trying to make, other than to say,
well, what do you do? Yeah. Is that where we're going?
Yeah, well, so that's right. The point was going to be, we've done macro deliberately. We've talked about the fact that rates, what do you do differently? Probably nothing. Can you say the same about a recession, mate? Is there any part of you that says, okay, well, rates are one thing, but gee, if the economy's going into a funk, this company, that company, that share price, do you at least think about your portfolio, or are you literally still equally agnostic as you were about rates in general?
No, I think about it, but then I kind of feel as though, if this stuff's making you think about it, good, but the lesson really is to always think about it. You know, be prepare, not don't react is probably the mantra to sort of have here. So it's not like... Let me be brutally honest. I mean, I'm down a lot. Yes. You know, I'm not enjoying it, you know.
Yep.
But at the same time, it's not, as I like to say, it's not my first rodeo. I've been here before, and there's a couple of things I know to be true. One is whatever opinions I tend to have in terms of where things are going to go over the next year or two, I've got no idea. I just don't. I mean, I could guess, but I'm not stupid enough to believe my own guesses. So, that makes it hard. So, I mean, how many times in the last 10 years that we've been speaking, I've sort of said, oh, things look really scary. And then the market, you know, you come back a couple of years later and it's just continued to go higher. So if I had freaked out and moved to cash or gold over any of those points in time, it may have seemed a little bit smart for a month or two. And then a year later, it's like massive egg all over the face. So I'm very hyper aware of that. So I think, before I even get to the investments, I think you've got to have a very good think about how you structure your life in general. And by that I mean, you know, have you been living below your means? Have you got savings? Have you been moderate in the level of debt that you've taken? If you haven't, it's kind of like, well, you're just in a much more difficult situation now. Yeah. I don't know. And if someone's waiting for, well, what do I do? It's like, I don't know, man. It's like, if you've been shooting heroin for the last 10 years, it's going to be hard getting off it. It just is.
Can't catch up with you,
I wish I wish I could say, oh, just do this and it's fixed. But the answer is that you need to have thought about, before you even think about what you do if you're your spare cash, you've got to structure your life appropriately. And if you haven't been doing that, now is the time to start going on the methadone. Now is the time to start thinking about just cutting back on the excesses that you don't need. And from there, it's just, well, it's business as usual. My company, when I look at my companies, the main question is, first question is, are they still around in 5-10 years?
Yep.
If the answer is no, well, that's an easy decision. Get the hell out. You know?
Is there some of that you've at least thought about in the context of higher rates and economic contractions, and some of those companies who are less, I'll say riskier, and I know that's a loaded term as well, but are there any you kind of thought, well, a few things had to go right, and man, the chance of them going right now, Elon Musk had years ago, if he'd gone through a recession early in Tesla's life, it may not be around today.
Yeah.
Now, easy to look back at Tesla and go, well, obviously, see how much it's up? Look, it was obvious it was going to be up. Yeah. It's not obvious at all other than in hindsight, which always fools everybody. Is there anything you're looking at going, oh, they might have a hard time getting through if this hangs on, or is that even a thought in terms of reviewing your portfolio?
But I mean that's not a thought that is a new thought. That is a thought that has been continually thought and thunk
for a
while. So I own a bunch of companies that aren't making profit at the moment.
Yep.
But for those companies, it's a question of, do they have the balance sheet capacity to weather any storm? And why aren't they making a profit? Is it because they're just not economically viable, or is it because they're spending a lot on growth investments? And if they are spending on growth investments, are they capable of pulling back on those growth investments? Which I would actually see as a detriment longer term. But if they had to, just to make sure they continue to pay the staff and stay in business, they can. Yeah. So I don't. Yeah. I think the answer to the I'm almost certainly wrong, at least on a number of them. Mm. But I feel as though they'll be around. I feel as though they'll weather the storm. I feel as though they'll emerge stronger the other side. I feel the longer term structural dynamics that are at play are going to benefit them significantly in the long term.
Okay.
And in the year 2032, I'll be glad. I mean, I'll probably wish I had done this and that a little bit differently, but I don't.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll be too upset. We'll see.
I like that. What do you think? So I haven't changed any positions in my portfolio. And to your point, I don't think I have any companies that are bleeding cash in my portfolio. I think they're all, if not profitable, at least cash flow positive. Some are doing better and worse than others. Companies we won't mention, 5 that are swear words for e-commerce. they're still profitable and if they are cash lending, it's only very slightly. There's no issue there. So from that perspective, my general approach is probably more mainstream than many, probably including yours. I don't mean yours is off the wall. Just, I don't tend to invest in a lot of loss-making companies or cash flow negative companies. My investing is boring for some people because I do look for those, strong brands, larger companies, all that kind of stuff, which is not going to blow the doors off anything when they go well. Generally speaking, they're not going to do too bad. So I didn't have to go back through my portfolio and go, oh my God, what goes broke in 3 months if they run out of cash type stuff. I haven't got anything in that space, which is nice. So that's just a thing. So I'm not doing anything particularly differently. The reason I want to ask the question was not so much about you or about me, although it's all about me, it's all about you. For our listeners, it's just thinking about exactly those sort of questions, right? So if you have businesses that are burning cash, if you have, even if they have the best idea, you've got to be around. You just have to be around. If you're waiting for good luck or good manager or momentum or customers to turn up or whatever, you've got to be around when that time comes. The very, very best ideas, if they don't have enough cash, won't make it through. We've talked before about a couple of those really, the 1 hour turnaround grocery delivery mobs. Two of them went to the wall in the last month and a half or 2 months because they simply, their funders went, nope, you don't have any more cash.
Yeah.
That was one of the really, really clear. And in the VC world, you're in much more trouble than in the public markets because they generally have shorter time frames and need more cash, but not exclusively.
And they can't cut back on their investments, right? Like, I mean, they are at a point where you can't pay staff. You just can't be in business.
Literally. Most of it is staff costs. They're not spending a fortune on marketing. Can we keep people, writing code? Can we do these things? So I'm not going to change much either, mate. I will... I will suggest to people that if you are, here's the other thing, market. So yeah, value wise or existence wise, existential threat wise, not worried. We will have more volatility in the coming months. That volatility will probably impact different businesses depending on how the market air quotes sees those businesses' futures. The market will always overweight short-term risks and opportunities and underweight long-term ones. So I own some businesses that are exposed to discretionary retail who have been smashed recently. I won't say I don't care, because losing money, I always care about losing money, but the long-term story of these companies is not one that is over in 3 months if there's a recession, right? These are long-term businesses that I think have good long-term potential. The other thing I will say to people really, really clearly is be careful about trying to, we talk about predictions, be really careful about trying to predict where the market is going to go next. And I've used the example before, and I'll use it again because it's a really nice recent one. There are plenty of people who said, I'll wait till COVID's over before I put my money back into the market. And since April 2020, the market must be up 70-odd%. I think the maths works out to something like that, since the lows of April 2020. While some people said, COVID's not over yet, I'll wait till COVID's over. And if and when we have a recession, it is probable, based on history, not absolute, but probable, the market low will be before the recession. And the market will be rising before the recession hits and right through the recession, because the market sucks a lot of the time, but it's pretty good, generally speaking, at looking forwards. And so there's a reason why the travel stocks were up at almost pre-COVID levels before flights went back into the air. Because the market looked forward and said, okay, in 3, 6, 9, 12 months, travel goes back to some sort of normal. These businesses are worth more than they are currently trading for now. We're happy to look through today's losses to tomorrow's profits when things get back to normal. We'll pay whatever the prices were for Flight Centre or Webjet or Hello World Travel or Corporate Travel Manager, own Webjet and Corporate Travel. We'll pay more for those companies than their current profitability is worth, because we see the future. And so realistically, I don't know if you would agree with this characterization, Ram, but generally speaking, the market bottoms precede the economic ones, and the recovery starts well ahead of the economic ones for exactly those reasons. And so just be really, really careful about trying to correlate the market and your trades with the actual economic data. Again, maybe this time is different, but generally speaking, if you wait for the information to be shown through in terms of economic activity, economic figures, it'll be too late to either sell or buy back. As we've always said, timing the market is hard to impossible. Probably not worth your time, even if it was possible, just because it's so incredibly difficult to get right. And you know, just investing regardless is probably smart. But just be really, really careful about trying to say, like, you know, if I said I'm going to sell my discretionary retailers today because it's going to be a recession. Now, maybe they fall further. Maybe I'm right to sell them today. I don't know. We can't know by definition. But I'm also absolutely sure by the time I say, okay, recession's over, it's safe to buy retail stocks again, they'll be up 20, 30, 40%, whatever the numbers end up being, for exactly the reason that the market seems to look forward and look through that stuff.
I think that was well said. Well said.
Any thoughts on that?
It's hard. There's theory and there's practice. And it's just—it's very difficult. What does he say? What's the
in
exact
theory? Phrase? There's no difference between theory and practice, right, but in practice, there is.
It's the same. I often contrast investing with health and fitness.
Yeah, right.
It's really easy to be healthy, right?
Yeah.
You know, eat lots of fruit and veggies and do exercise. It's really, you know, you don't need a personal trainer, right? Like it's the easiest thing ever. Stop drinking the cans of Coke, you know, stop eating, you know, the kebab for lunch every day.
Yep, exactly.
Is it easy to do? No, it's really hard. Kebabs taste easy, right? Fantastic. Yep. Coke is brilliant. You know, it's sort of...
No one likes to exercise when other people don't anyway, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's sort of exactly. That's why there's so many parallels. So it's kind of...
Yep.
You know, anyone listening here, you know what you have to do, and only you can do it. I wish you every success, because I understand it's hard. And I think, Scott, you and I both battle with it. We've been doing it for decades, literally decades now. And I think you still battle with it.
Oh, totally. So. That's my point. We're going back to where we started. Was during COVID, I didn't want to invest, but I did anyway, because I knew I just had to and should.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't that it didn't feel good and it felt scary and all those things still happen. That's what I've said many, many times. Don't wait until the market doesn't scare you anymore. Just get to the point of it's scary, but I'm doing it anyway because I know it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's again, I'll steal your exercise analogy. I hate exercising, mate. I just, some people get a really big endorphin rush. I really, really don't. And so I don't do as much as I should. And you know, my figure is a testament to that. But when I do it because I should when I do it. And I don't go, oh, this is amazing. See how good it is? Like, I'm not going to wait till I love exercising, right? Otherwise, I'll be on the couch forever. I do it and go, I don't like doing this, but I'm doing it. And that's kind of the analogy of, like, just stick with it. Do your thing. Even if it doesn't feel good, even if it feels scary, even if you're not sure. Because if you kind of fall back on, again, the theory of weight loss or healthy living, the theory of investing, the Vanguard Index chart that I mentioned every second podcast says that, you know, maybe this time is different. I can never, ever, ever promise anything. Same as you can have a heart attack exercising, right? It doesn't guarantee you're going to have a long and healthy life. But to my mind, a really, really, really high likelihood that gritting your teeth and doing it anyway is worth it in both cases.
Well, just to stretch the analogy a little bit further too, it's just sort of like we've got to end, I know, but to be healthy, you don't have to go to the gym for 3 hours each day and only eat chicken breast. And you know what I mean? Like, some people who are way into their health, they're way into it, right? And obviously the results kind of are there. But it's the same with investing. Like you just say, you said before, you know, you hate exercising, the rest of it. But do you know what? It's like, eat the occasional salad and try and get 10,000 steps in a day. There's a world of difference between that and 4 hours at the gym. And I feel as though there's an analogy, there was a parallel there when it comes to investing. You can be the kind of person who, you know, has 400 spreadsheets and, you know, reads every single release from a company and gets way, way into the weeds. Or you can be the kind of person who just like, oh yeah, I spend a bit less than I earn. I save it up. At the end of every quarter, I put it into an ETF, right? It's kind of that thing. Like, in theory, you won't go as well as you could potentially by being the hardcore investing person who just goes way all in type thing, but you're still going to do really well. And just as eating the occasional salad and going for a walk once or twice a day is going to have huge long-term compounding benefits on your health as opposed to never doing anything. And that's really the lesson here. It's like, doing nothing in both cases is bad. Doing a little bit, there's a huge difference. So just do something. Mm-hmm. Just do something.
Yep, perfect, mate. I think it's exactly the right way to think about it. So let's go with that. All right, mate, I think we're probably done. Will you join me on Sunday?
Yeah, 100%.
We'll answer some of your questions. By the way, if you want your question answered, now is a spectacularly good time. As I said last week, I'm going away for a little while and I won't be answering questions during that, but we will pre-record some answers. So if you have something on your mind, a burning question, a topic, a statement, a comment, a criticism, we'll ignore those. No, I'm kidding. But if you have anything you want to share with us and particularly you want us to talk about on the podcast, please let us know. info@fool.com.au. Follow us on all of the socials on Twitter. Andrew is at @Sage_Simeon. That's Wise Monkey or something. Anyway, or @StrawmanInvest. You get me on Twitter or Insta @TMFScottP. And The Motley Fool @TheMotleyFoolAU. On Facebook, go to facebook.com/ScottPhillipsMoney or facebook.com/TheMotleyFoolAustralia. And don't forget to hit play on your podcast machine on Sunday at midday, Australian Eastern Standard Time. We'll be back with a mailbag episode. See you then. Fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.